This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge. Annette Gordon-Reed has done us the honor to be with us. Bill Russell, I, Paula. You're a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And some of what I found really fascinating about this is how the law changes. Mm-hmm. That, in fact, if I remember correctly, three of the four children that Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson have, and they come to life in the Hemingses of Monticello as a real family, mm-hmm. even if he is 30 years older than she is. The law is absolutely at the center of this story, mm-hmm. or you wouldn't have all of this, well, the cultural overlay, of course, as well. Three of the four children of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings go into society as white. Mm-hmm. And in fact, are white under Virginia law at some point.
Yes, yes.
So the what is white, what is of color, what is African?
Well, Sally at one point under Virginia law was white.
Well, she's listed in one of the censuses as a white person.
But at one point, wasn't 25% considered?
I think so. I think it was one-eighth. I think it was 1/8.
Because you talk about quadroons and octoroons, yeah. which is familiar to those of us who've read Faulkner.
Well, yeah. New Orleans.
Yeah. The idea that having three white grandparents mm-hmm. made you white, this changes over time. Mm-hmm. And having Jim Crow between us and them mm-hmm. changes how we think of this as well.
Oh, exactly, exactly. Although, I mean, yes, her children were considered white by Virginia law, but the notion that you were part African-American was still a problem. The interesting thing that I found is that sort of contemplating the fact that three of these children passed for white, and the youngest one, Eston, was described as, he was the person that I described before, as light bronze colored with a visible admixture of Negro blood, which is what Ohio, that's the standard that they went to because people were saying, wait a minute, I don't care if the law says this person is 1/8, you know, black, and so therefore they're white. I could look at that person and tell they're not all white. So there was sort of a rebellion against that idea, and they went to the visible admixture standard. It's interesting to me that a lot of people who were passing for white, it didn't mean that you know, look like Max von Sydow. I mean, you could be someone who looked black, but people accepted. You know, the people in the community, people don't usually engage in vigilante stuff unless they are insecure.
Or stirred up, or whatever.
And most people leave folks alone. I mean, they would say, well, you know, he says he's white, but I know, you know. And you let people go, you know. There were people who passed for white. Passing for white during that time did not mean that you had to look, as I said, exactly like a white person.
But there also were people from, not as many as later came into the nation, from all other parts of the world.
Yes, exactly. And people would claim to be part Portuguese. That was a favorite one. Part Italian. Certainly when Eston moves up to Wisconsin, they're probably French-Canadian people, people who are mixed with Native Americans. You know, so there were ways, there were explanations for why a person might have been, you know, bronzed colored, and or maybe it had curly hair or whatever. So, yes, but the changing notions of what is race, I mean, Jefferson thought that a person who was 1/8, you know, black was a white person. And with our one drop rule, that would not have passed muster in Virginia in the 20th century. So it's fascinating. There's no one static way of viewing all of this.
You also remind us of the important distinction between people who were opposed to slavery vis-a-vis a racist perspective, which mm-hmm. which I think confuses a lot of people. We automatically assume that all the abolitionists mm-hmm. Were not racist, which of course is the evidence is overwhelming that's not the case.
Oh yeah,
and that's an important part of American history, is that that distinction is lost, and we tend to think, particularly in the time prior to the Civil War, of a group of people who were abolitionists against, opposed to slavery, but also were rabid racists.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the abolitionists, people like William Lloyd Garrison was someone who was anti-slavery and also believed in equality. I mean, and there's a wonderful book called All on Fire. I'm plugging someone else's book by Henry Mayer, but it's a fabulous book that talks about Garrison. And
Who has mostly been lost to the 20th century, and he was a giant of a man.
He was a giant of a man, and he was not just anti-slavery, but he struggled with the issues of race, but ultimately believed that blacks and whites could live together in this society, and was not opposed to interracial marriages and so forth. So there are people like that, but a lot of abolitionists.
John Brown, don't forget John Brown.
John Brown is there. John Brown as well.
And John Brown, it's a little plug here for abolitionist John Brown. John Brown, Abolitionist the Book, is also a wonderful place to be reacquainted. John Brown set up a colony where black people sat at the table with white people and ate together, which was sort of the ultimate no-no.
And he wasn't even sexist.
Imagine.
Well, that's the thing, that there's sort of a buried history of progressive traditions in American life, and we tend to think that all white people had one viewpoint back at that time period, and that's not true at all. There was a tradition of progressivism in the 18th century and the 19th century with people like Garrison, but you're right, abolitionists were not all anti-racist. I talk a little bit about John Quincy Adams, whose anti-slavery credentials are clear, but he was clearly a racist. There's no question about it, and that's something that there were two things to get rid of: slavery, and also this notion of white supremacy. And that's something that is a more continuing struggle.
And you talk about white supremacy really, really well, because a lot of people forget that it isn't racist alone, it is white supremacy. And that is over all people of color. It isn't just those out of Africa. It is a sense of white is it.
Yeah.
It was also, it took me 100 pages. It was hard to read this book the way you wrote it, because I've read so much about Jefferson that I kept referring back to Jefferson. It sort of became the center point. Yeah. I kept forgetting what this book was about. I was 100 pages in before I realized what the subtitle said. This is an American family. And that actually, thank you, was a new idea. I am so accustomed to thinking of enslaved people, blacks, in this country, principally, almost exclusively, in this country, as being somehow or other fully separated prior to emancipation. And what you do, wonderfully, I think, is to demonstrate, show hour by hour, day by day, incident by incident, that these were people, that they are not only people, they are our ancestors. They are part of the founding fathers and mothers of this country. Their legal circumstances were somewhere well beyond unfortunate. But they are part of who and what we are. And that, to me, is a major understanding that I think is missing. Certainly was missing in my perspective, and I think it's probably missing in most Americans' perspectives.
Well, thank you. I mean, American family is important as a subtitle, but it's also your point about law is interesting as well, how law shapes our reality. And law creates a group of winners, and law creates a group of losers. And if you don't have law, the thinking is, because blacks were not, enslaved people were not in law in the same way whites were, that there's nothing there. It's total chaos. And you see this family, just even from the family tree, that tries to keep its family together, managed to be kept together because Jefferson lived a very long time. And because the Hemingses were part of his family in lots of ways, they were, for the most part, all together for almost five decades in one place. A lot of enslaved people were separated and were not able to maintain their family ties. But here's a family that did, and they did it by sticking up for each other, buying each other's freedom at the end to try to keep people together, naming practices. I mean, the Hemingses, I mean, one of the confusing things about this is that they're Critters and Marys and Betsys and Sarah.
Across
Sally Hemings' name is Sally Hemings' name was Sarah, and so you see all these Sarahs here and there, and that's how you what do people do when law doesn't exist? There are still ways for people to try to maintain those contacts, and as you said, just because you see their enslaved status does not mean that there was no coherence to their lives that we can latch onto.
Well, and it is also important to say, I think it was Herbert Gutman who first made it really clear that the black family is real, it was strong, it had immense challenges, but not to forget the black family was a family, and in this case, the Hemingses...
It's part of our best efforts.
Indeed.
Exactly. And you see this, I mean, you go around any major airport in the summer, and you walk around, you'll see people with funny t-shirts on, you know, the Jones family reunion, this notion of identity. I don't think that for many whites understand how searing the loss of identity and family connections was for blacks. And they tried to, as I said, with the Hemingses, to keep that together. But even after slavery, when people, you know, there's stories about people walking, you know, miles across states and so forth to try to gather everybody together. And lots of times they were successful, but this notion that they didn't care and there was no connection is just
false. Well, it also reflects a modern dilemma. I think it was Mary Catherine Bateson who talks about the stripped nuclear family, mm-hmm. you know, two parents, two kids. And that is that's sort of the American stereotype, and that is a very novel view in world history.
Oh, absolutely.
And in many ways, the black community, and I'm generalizing, has done a much better job of creating and maintaining family than I think on average than the white community, because I don't think blacks ever adopted this stripped nuclear family notion that two adults, two children is a family.
That can also be said of people of Asian heritage and people of Spanish heritage. Really, it's the white supremacy bit the white population in pretty serious ways. In addition to all the legal things, when you look at and I think that the law, I hadn't thought about it that way before, thank you, Bill, the law really kind of forces that onto the white people who have enforced the law.
Yeah, exactly.
And created the law.
Well, it's the notion of extended families, because if you live in a place where, under a situation now, it's not to, again, it's, these things come to the fore in sort of a bad way because people are separated. But even before, there's this notion of sort of, to the extent that blacks kept African kinship notions to some degree in there, it's your extended family. And one of the things I talk about here is how this notion of marrying your cousins, that is sort of, there was a lot of cross-cultural mixture in terms of blacks and whites, but that's not one that blacks adopted, because under sort of African kinship notions, your first cousins are like your brothers and sisters in a way. And so people sort of, Gutman talks about this, wondering why that was not a cultural adaptation that blacks had. Like a lot of Virginia families where Jefferson's daughters marry a half first cousin, or they marry their first and second cousin. So this notion of an extended family where cousins are like brothers and sisters and mother, grandmother is like mother and grandfather and all those things is something that, you know, that was maintained by necessity, a combination of keeping traditions, but also the necessity of the slave system that said you had to look after your own. If they were separated from family members.
And the white aristocracy was interested in maintaining the exclusivity, which is why one of the reasons that they tended to basically intermarry.
Oh, yeah.
And this had to do with property. We'll do property, Madam Lawyer, when we come back in just a moment with Annette Gordon-Reed. Stay tuned.